Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. Our guest is retired United States Geological Survey scientist Donald Swanson. In the spring of 1980, he and a team of his fellow volcanologists heard about the initial rumblings of the Cascade volcano, Mount St. Helens. Little known to the American public at the time, the volcano was well known to geologists as one of the most active in the Cascade Range. In the continental United States, the only eruption to occur in the 20th century was Lassen Peak in Northern California, which was very active during World War II but never took a human life. Such was not to be the case with Mount St. Helens, whose explosive eruption produced pyroclastic blasts that killed 57 people, destroyed over 200 homes, killed thousands of big game animals, and 12 million fish. The state of volcano science was actually pretty primitive in 1980, and the lessons learned from that eruption have led to extensive monitoring of volcanoes in California and the Pacific Northwest. Our guest was at the center of that confluence of volcanology and tragedy in 1980. U.S. Geological Survey volcanologist Donald Swanson recently retired from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. But in 1980, he and a team of USGS geologists headed to Mount St. Helens for what would prove to be both a human tragedy and a boon to volcano science, revolutionizing our understanding of the explosive types of mountains found in the Pacific Northwest. Don Swanson joined us from his home in Hilo, Hawaii, to tell us about his memories of the eruption of Mount St. Helens 40 years ago.
That's right. I am recently retired from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and I'm in Hilo, Hawaii, now at home.
Before we get into Mount St. Helens, let's talk about the state of volcanology just prior to 1980, and specifically about how the Volcano Observatory in Hawaii was functioning, really as the repository for all of our knowledge in the United States, anyway, about volcanoes.
Yeah, we were, myself and others were involved with monitoring Hawaiian volcanoes, and we're doing a reasonably good job of what I think, given the problems with the remedial equipment at the time. And it was the only volcano observatory in the country, really. We had expertise in Hawaii, but nowhere else. And so that when 1980 came along in Mount St. Helens, we were really scrambling to try to figure out what to do and how to do it.
Well, and they're two very different types of volcanoes. So for our listeners, could you just briefly explain the difference between a Hawaiian-type volcano like Kilauea there and our Cascade Arc volcanoes here like Mount St. Helens?
Yeah, in Hawaii, the volcanoes have been erupting lava flows most of the time. And while the lava flows can be destructive, they aren't particularly violent. And for the past 200 years, there haven't been many very large explosions. In the Cascade volcanoes, the situation is very different. Those volcanoes build up steep-sided cones because their lavas are less fluid, and they can be more explosive more frequently than the Hawaiian volcanoes. So the two are really quite different. They erupt different chemical compositions of lava, and they present significantly different hazards to the population.
Well, let's talk about Mount St. Helens, and let's start by, like, why is it there? Because, you know, it's very interesting to me to understand the tectonic setting, but, you know, for a lot of our listeners, they may not truly understand why the Cascade volcanoes are there. So could you explain to us the process that creates them?
Yeah, the Cascade volcanoes are developed over a subducting plate. Now, what that means is that there's a plate of the oceanic crust that is diving beneath the continental plate, and it carries sediments down with it. And then at some point, there is some melting that takes place, sometimes involving these sediments. They melt to form magma, which then rises and erupts along the what we call the Cascade Arc. And Mount St. Helens is one of those volcanoes in the Cascade Arc. Lassen Peak and Mount Shasta are others.
And let's talk about Mount St. Helens specifically. Give us a thumbnail sketch of its biography, if you will, its geological biography, because it's a relatively young volcano, isn't it?
Yeah, Mount St. Helens is really quite young, although it's the work that is being done now geologically shows that it's had the earlier periods of activity, but still going back no more than a million or so years old, whereas at many of the other volcanoes, there's much longer history. So as a result of its relative youth, geologically speaking, of course, it's been among the most active volcanoes in the Cascades. And at the time, in 1980 and before that, if anybody would have guessed what the next volcano to erupt would have been, it would have been either Lassen Peak, because, of course, it had its eruptions in 1914, 1917, or Mount St. Helens.
And Mount St. Helens had had eruptions that were particularly violent in the past. Can you maybe tell us about some of those precursor eruptions and the size of them?
Yeah, Mount St. Helens had erupted ash and pumice several times, well, in fact, many times during the preceding few thousand years. And some of this ash was distributed across eastern Washington. There had been mudflows or lahars generated by the eruptions. There was probably one small collapse of the volcano that took place a couple thousand years ago, I think, but also some lava flows too. So it had been a very active place. And most recently, in the early 19th century, there had been an eruption at the volcano that had been painted actually by the Canadian artist Paul Kane. So it was pretty clear that St. Helens was near or at the top of the list for volcanoes that could erupt again.
Okay, well, let's go forward in geologic time to basically the present, because geologically speaking, 1980 is like a second or two ago. And let's talk about what the state of the volcano was prior to March 1980, because at that time, it was a place where people loved to go fishing and recreate. There was a lot of logging activity, I believe it was Weyerhaeuser, all around the volcanic mountain. And it was a beautiful cone too, wasn't it? Didn't they call it the Mount Fuji of North America?
Oh yes, it was very symmetrical. It rose up above its surroundings beautifully, and so it really looked like a volcano, if you know what I mean. Anybody could see it from a distance with some knowledge of volcanoes and recognize that it was a volcano.
And then, okay, let's go towards the eruptions. How did this all begin? Wasn't it with an earthquake in March? What was the initial signal that the mountain was waking up from its slumbers?
Yeah, the first indication was on March 20th, I believe, with an earthquake that came from somewhere near Mount St. Helens. The University of Washington was monitoring. I was in charge of the seismic monitoring at that time, and they identified the earthquake as near Mount St. Helens. And then during the next day or two or three, there were more earthquakes, and the relatively crude network at the time was nonetheless quite consistently showing that the earthquakes were very near Mount St. Helens, and they were so shallow that the university seismologists felt that the earthquakes were almost certainly related to the volcano. And the seismicity gradually picked up from after March 20th. And then on March 27th, there was the first explosion from the volcano, and that put the nail in the coffin. We knew then for certain that the earthquakes were coming from the volcano, and that they indicated that magma was moving into the volcano.
Okay, so where are you when you first start to find out about the mountain activating, and when were you deployed and your team deployed to Mount St. Helens?
Well, we were in Menlo Park, California. We had just returned from a meeting, geological meeting in Oregon. And because of the increasing seismicity, Bob Christensen, who was in charge of the volcano people at the time, called a meeting. I don't remember the exact day, but it was probably about March 23rd, March 24th, something like that. And we made plans as to what was going to be our response should something actually take place. And Chris set up a team of individuals, and I was put in charge of the geodetic monitoring of the volcano, and Jim Moore was involved and others. And we were thinking that if this thing does start erupting, that we will catch the first flight up to Portland after the, you know, after we hear that, that there's been an eruption. And that's just exactly what happened. We learned of the explosion on the afternoon of March 27th, and we were on the next flight up to Portland, Jim and I. We met others who had come in from Denver. They were the geologists who had been studying the past history of the volcano. And so we all sort of got semi-organized at the hotel where we were staying in the Forest Service building, which was a temporary headquarters for our St. Helens work, in the evening on March 27th. So I think that's a pretty rapid response for the time.
And as time unfolds here, as we go into May, tell us about, by the time of the great eruption, how many USGS and other scientists were deployed?
Well, the number of scientists at any one time varied because people came and went. All of us had other duties that we were doing, you know, other projects that we were working on, and we couldn't just toss aside. So we would come in for a week or two at a time and then go back and be replaced by somebody else. So there were, I would imagine, all told, usually there would be on the order of a dozen or so people. Some of us working in the field, monitoring the volcano. Others were in the offices in Vancouver, and they were primarily dealing with the other governmental agencies that were involved.
And you mentioned that you were in charge of the geodetic aspect of this. Could you explain to our listeners what is geodesy? What does that mean?
Well, what I mean by that is that if a volcano is deforming, is changing shape because magma is coming into, is pushing its way up and causing the volcano to swell, then the volcano changes shape, and you can measure it by geodetic means, that is, by surveying the volcano. We knew that this happened in at Kilauea and at Mauna Loa, but we didn't know if a volcano like Mount St. Helens would swell before an eruption. This was, you know, it seems ridiculous for now to think that we were questioning that possibility, but we really didn't know at the time. So when Jim Moore and I arrived, and others came up from Menlo Park, California as well, we didn't know what to expect. And so everything that we were doing was based on the assumption that there would be deformation of the volcano without knowing if there really would be. And that was, it was really quite remarkable to when we started seeing visually this bulge form on the north side of the volcano. And this was visual evidence that, yes, indeed, the volcano was deforming big time.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom, and we're looking back at Mount St. Helens 40 years after the great eruption of May 18th, 1980. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's resume now as we reminisce with USGS volcanologist Don Swanson about the great eruption of Mount St. Helens 40 years ago.
Well, on the morning of May 18th, the bulge had grown to a tremendous size. It was moving outward at a meter and a half a day at some localities on it. So you had this big tumor growing on the north flank of the volcano. The morning of May 18th, there was the landslide, as you said, a big earthquake, a magnitude 5.3 earthquake that was associated with the landslide. And it's at the time we thought that the earthquake triggered the landslide. I think the seismic interpretation now is that the earthquake was caused by the landslide. But anyway, that this big bulge that had been growing was becoming more and more unstable failed. It started to slide down slope. This removed pressure on the magma, which had been intruding high into the volcano and causing the bulge to form. As the magma came in, the volcano made room for it by bulging outward. When the bulge began to fail in this gigantic landslide, then it depressurized the magma, which had gases in it, and the gases then exploded out. And so you had a small vertical ash column ejected, but mainly because of the removal of the north side of the volcano by the landslide, most of the explosion was directed toward the north. And all of these gases that were in the intruding magma, as well as steam from heated snow and ice on the volcano, caused this surge of material to move northward. And that's the lateral blast that we called it at the time, lateral blast, that moved across the landslide and was responsible for downing the old growth timber for several miles out from the volcano, and caused the deaths of many people as a result. In the meantime, the landslide, which was moving rapidly but not as fast as the surge, sped down into the Toutle River Valley, which drains Spirit Lake north of the volcano, and transformed into what is called a debris avalanche, this mass of rocky material from the volcano that was moving down the valley floor. And that debris avalanche moved many miles, carrying pieces of glacial ice with it, and filled the volcanoes, the valley of the Toutle River, which drained the volcano. You can see all this wonderfully today from the top of Johnston Ridge. And then out of the debris avalanche, later in the afternoon came water was oozing out of the debris avalanche, generated lahars or mud flows that rushed down the Toutle River into the Cowlitz and Columbia Rivers and caused shipping problems for days afterward. Now, this was all happening on the north side of the volcano. Everything was on the north side, but there were small mud flows that came down the south side of the volcano as well, because the top of the volcano, the ice and snow on the top of the volcano was being melted as it was collapsing. And so lahars went down some of the valleys that drained toward the south of the volcano as well. So it was... the main show was on the north side. That's where the timber was blown down, washed into Spirit Lake, where the debris avalanche went, the lateral blast. But there was also activity on the south side of the volcano. Later in the day, then, even more things happened on the north side. And this was the incredible thing. There were, as the eruption column from the volcano grew really tall, it became too dense for itself, and part of it collapsed down to form what are called pyroclastic flows, avalanches of pus that moved rapidly down out of the crater and down the north side of the volcano and formed what today is called the pumice plain, this large area at the north base of the volcano with many, you know, with lots of pumice in it. And you can walk across that on one of the trails, I think, in the National Monument. What happened, of course, as the bulge was removed by the landslide, of course, this removed the top of the volcano. It decapitated the volcano. So the volcano didn't blow its top. It lost its top by the landslide. And this eventually resulted in the large crater that we have today in the volcano, which is almost a mile wide and very, very large and deep feature. And this was all created on those terrific events on the morning and early afternoon of May 18th. Now, I've gone on at length about this because it's important to realize all of these events were following one after the other and sometimes at the same time. And so it's really difficult to pick out individual events that were happening. It was all kind of a collage of everything that was happening at one time. You need to think of it as this one really mega and very complicated event rather than a series of smaller, shorter events. So I apologize for being so long, but that's the way it is.
No, that was fascinating. What I'd like to know now is before we go any further, and I want to talk about where you were the morning, because I want to talk about your experiences in a minute. But first, let's talk about your colleague, David Johnston. And I want you to tell us where he was, how close he was, and of course, you know, what I kind of hate to ask this, but what must it have been like for him in those final seconds?
Well, David was at our observation post that we called Coldwater 2, which was located on the ridge now called Johnson Ridge, named after him, near the visitor center up there. And he had replaced Harry Glicken, a student who had been there for 10 days or 2 weeks, I think, before, who had to leave. And so Dave came in to replace him for just that night, the night of May 17th. And I should tell you the story because it's been in a lot of accounts that Dave and I discussed whether he or I would be there. We discussed it on, I think, on about May 16th or so, 15th maybe. I had a graduate student from Germany visiting me, and I wanted to take him in the field on May 17th because it was his only chance to see the volcano. And so I told Dave that I would come up and replace Dave on the morning of May 18th if Dave could spend the night of May 17th there. And so that was the agreement, and that's why he was there. Now, early in the morning of May 18th, he made measurements to the bulge, and he saw that the bulge was still moving, though the rate that he got was a little slower than what it had been, but that's probably just within the noise of the measurements itself. And then he made his famous radio transmission, Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it. I didn't hear that, and I can't imagine what he was thinking at the time. I would hope that he was scrambling to try to find some place to hide, but of course that didn't do him any good. But it would have been a terrifying few tens of seconds for him at Coldwater 2.
Yeah, because that pyroclastic surge of material, you know, that's traveling at what, a couple hundred miles an hour, of this incredibly superheated material, you have no chance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was a an observer who was working for the state who was on the next ridge or two out farther from the volcano than Dave was. And he reported in his radio transmission that the cloud, or I forget the word that he used, has got the trailer. And that's where Dave was at the trailer. And it's going to get me too, he said. And indeed it did. He was never found as well. So it was a terrifying few minutes there.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, the sense of loss and I don't know what words to use, irony you must have felt, knowing that, there but for your visiting student, you would have been you.
Well, that's right. And I, to be honest with you, I think about it almost every day. And the student has gone on to do really good things professionally. We see each other at meetings, and this always comes up. His name is Gerhard Werner. Gerhard, it turns out, was quite good at sketching. And so he was put to use in Vancouver at the Forest Service building to make sketches on May 18th and 19th of sketches based on radio reports that we sent in. And he was sketching, and those sketches were going out to the media. Remember, in those days, we didn't have a digital photography. You couldn't take a photograph and put it out. And so his sketches were very, very valuable.
Yeah, you had to develop film, and that takes time. Okay, let's talk about you on that morning, because you got up in a helicopter pretty quickly, because I've seen some pretty amazing 16-millimeter film footage that you took, right?
Yeah, I was waiting in the Forest Service office in Vancouver with another USGS geologist. And I was waiting. Somebody was going to bring me some supplies that I was going to take with me up to Coldwater 2 to replace Dave Johnston. So we were watching the seismographs, and suddenly they went bonkers. Something big had happened. And so I waited a few seconds to make sure that this wasn't something instrumental, and we were seeing it on all the seismometers. So I then ran upstairs, tried to radio Dave, and got no reply, and then came downstairs. And already the Forest Service had arranged to have one of their spotter planes fly up to make observations. So I rushed to the airport in Vancouver, Washington, and jumped on the spotter plane. And as soon as we lifted off, I could see that the top of the volcano was gone. It was used to come up to a sharp peak, and now it was truncated. Luckily, we had a good weather day. Visibility was really good. So as we were flying up, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. But indeed, the volcano had lost its top. And there was this big eruption column coming out of the from the top of the volcano. Later we learned that there was a crater there. And so I took lots of photographs of that and some movies. And then we got close to the volcano, but we couldn't get around to the north side. There was so much ash in the air there that the pilot couldn't go there. And so we flew back and forth, doing figure eights, east to west, back and forth, south of the volcano, witnessing the eruption column. It was all this ash. It was rising turbulently in the air. We saw a lot of lightning strikes off to the east. We saw the mud flows moving down the south side of the volcano, southeast, southwest sides of the volcano. And we heard on radio reports that something had happened along the Toodle River, but we couldn't really piece things together very well. And I'll tell you, I hadn't been up there for too long when I realized that that we must have lost Dave, because there was so much activity on the north side of the volcano that we could see from a distance that we couldn't get there, that I didn't understand how anybody could have survived that at all. So I was up there in the plane until we had to return for fuel around, 1240 or something, 1245 that day. And it was, it was a very sobering experience to think that something that I'd been standing on the top of the day before, I'd been up there with a helicopter pilot, and we he shut down the helicrat engine on the morning of May 17th, and we walked over and looked down at the crater. It's something that I'd been on the day before had turned so nasty so quickly.
Wow.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at Mount St. Helens 40 years later with retired USGS volcanologist Don Swanson. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with Donald Swanson. As a United States Geological Survey scientist 40 years ago, he was smack dab in the middle of the most destructive volcanic eruptions in U.S. history, the Great Eruption of Mount St. Helens on May 18th, 1980. So you're in an airplane and taking some pretty incredible footage. And I want to talk about what that footage looks like in those photographs, because that eruption column is pretty dramatic looking, and it's called a Plinian eruption. And I'm wondering if you could explain to us where that name comes from and why it looks like that.
You know, a Plinian eruption has a large column of ash and pumice that rises for tens of thousands of feet into the air, sometimes 40,000 feet, even more at times. It comes from the name of Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y, who observed the eruption at Mount Vesuvius in Italy in 79 A.D. That's the eruption that destroyed Pompeii and Herculaneum. It was a very large eruption column, and it was described so well that geologists have taken on the name Pliny or Plinian to describe this kind of activity. And so there it was right before our eyes in the airplane. But, you know, the eeriest thing was that we couldn't hear a sound. There were the engines of the plane were loud enough so we couldn't hear any sound coming from this really magnificent display of nature's power right before our very eyes. It was like watching a silent movie with no organ accompaniment.
Wow. If you could be on the ground without dying or being in danger, would you hear it? Would it be loud?
I think people, survivors, heard it, but I don't think it was as loud as one might anticipate. I've never heard anybody talking about deafening sounds, but they can definitely hear sound.
Because it looks like it should be this roaring, you know, thunderous sound coming out of it. That's interesting. Okay, let's talk about there were 57 people that lost their lives on that day. This was the biggest and most tragic volcanic disaster in U.S. history. And on the scale of volcanic eruptions throughout history, recorded history, you know, not the biggest, but, you know, it was a big one. I want to talk about some of the other people you knew, most notably the famous Harry Truman. And when I was looking on Google the other day, they have these, you know, the questions people ask on Google. And one of the ones said, what American president was killed by Mount St. Helens? It's like, no, not the same guy. Could you tell us about Harry Truman?
Well, Harry, or he actually called himself Truman, usually, was quite a personage. He had a resort at Spirit Lake. He stayed there all winter long. He had a number of cats, 17 cats, I think, to come to mind, that lived inside. And of course, the cat litter had long been used up, so you can imagine how the place smelled when you went into it. Sure. He was very helpful to us, to Jim Moore and others, and me. He allowed us to install a piece of equipment to measure changes in air pressure in his cabin, and we used that to time when there were explosions taking place in late April and early May at night, when we couldn't see them, but there would be an air pressure change, and this instrument in his lodge helped us with that. He was really iconoclastic, and that he thought that he knew what was going to happen for certain. He became kind of a folk hero. I think for that reason, he was going to stay there and weather it out. And I think he kind of talked himself into a corner. I worry that as the days progressed and the bulge started getting bigger and bigger, that he really would have preferred to leave, but felt that he couldn't because he had kept saying that he wasn't going to. Harry Truman was a wordsmith, in that he knew all the four-letter words in the English language and maybe in other languages too. He's well known for that. I tell people that I didn't learn any new words from Harry Truman, but I did learn new combinations of words. But he was able to watch his language well enough so that he was brought out one day, and he talked to some to a school in Oregon about what he was doing, and he came back, and so he was he was a complex person. I don't think Harry has been described adequately by anybody. He obviously liked people, but he wanted to live alone. He felt that he knew what was going to happen, but as I said, I think he had doubts at the end. But when it happened, it happened. And I don't think it took much time for the lateral blast and the debris avalanche to get to him on May 18th.
Yeah, so he would have been pretty much buried along with Spirit Lake pretty quickly.
Yeah, he probably was swept up by the debris avalanche and carried out into the lake somewhere. Yeah, we just don't know. That nothing survives from that area.
No. And then there was, I know you told me a story not too long ago about another, was I think a student of yours, and you were out on a survey after the eruption, I believe in a helicopter this time, whereas previously, you, as you said, you were in an airplane. Could you tell us about that? Because I found that to be a very poignant story.
Yeah, he was a graduate student at the University of Idaho named Jim Fitzgerald. A really nice guy, a veteran, who was studying some ancient lava flows in the Columbia River basalt for his PhD thesis. And I was working on the Columbia River basalt at that time. And so I had met him, and we'd been on a couple of field trips together, and we became acquaintances. And I had no idea that he was coming over to Mount St. Helens. On the morning of May 19th, the day after the eruption, I was in a helicopter with Jim Moore and Pete Lippman, and we spent many hours that day trying to figure out what had happened. As we were first approaching the volcano from the south, so we saw this blue Datsun. It's called a Nissan now, but it was a Datsun at the time, close to the volcano, to the west side of the volcano. And we thought, oh. So we tried to land the volcano, but there was too much blowing ash in the air that was stirred up by the rotors. So we couldn't land. So we backed off, and about that time, one of the search and rescue helicopters was coming in. They lowered a rope out, and a guy rappelled down to the car and put a sign on the car indicating that there was a body in the car, and then lifted off. Well, it turns out that that was my friend Jim Fitzgerald that was sitting at the steering wheel of the car. And I've often thought what my feeling would have been if we had been able to land. And I had seen Jim there without having any idea that he was going to be anywhere but in Moscow, Idaho.
Yeah, because you had no idea that that was his car when you were hovering there.
I had no idea. So I've been forever grateful that we couldn't land. It would have been a very traumatic thing to happen.
Well, let's shift now to perhaps more pleasant things, and let's talk about the lessons learned by the USGS and people like yourself. How did the eruption of Mount St. Helens really revolutionize our study of volcanoes like these in the Cascades?
Well, you know, the eruption was, I like to term it, the iconic, because for so many reasons, one turns back to St. Helens as a good example. The first was that we now know that if a volcano begins to bulge in the way that Mount St. Helens does, watch out, because that means that there could be this wholesale failure of the bulge and generating all of the things that occurred on May 18th, the debris, landslide, lateral blast, debris avalanche, and so forth. This was the first time that a laterally directed, sideways directed eruption had been demonstrated at a volcano. There had been an eruption in Kamchatka, a Besmiani eruption, the eruption had occurred a few years earlier in the dead of winter, and the report was kind of sketchy, and these were Cold War times, and so there wasn't much communication between the Soviets and the Western world, and so although people were thinking about that as an analog for what might happen in St. Helens, seeing it happen at St. Helens really demonstrated that this kind of lateral eruption, lateral blast can occur. Another very important thing was the magnitude of the landslide and its transformation down in the Toodle Valley into a debris avalanche, which resulted in topography that was very hilly, or hummocky, we call it. And at other volcanoes in the world, people had scratched their heads over what such hummocky topography that they could see actually meant. And now we knew. We had seen it at St. Helens. So instantly, people started to recognize by now hundreds of debris avalanches that have occurred from volcanoes around the world. And this means that those volcanoes have had major failures of their slope to have generated a landslide and debris avalanche. And the hummocky topography that you can see from I-5,
Mount Shasta?
Shasta is a good example. Yeah. People puzzled about that. Was it glacial? What was it? And then as soon as it happened at St. Helens, we knew instantly what that was. So
That's really interesting, Don, because as soon as you were describing that image of those hummocky areas off I-5 north of Mount Shasta, that instantly popped in my head as I was thinking about, have I ever seen anything like that? And it was like, that image literally popped into my head when you said that.
That's right, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Another thing that happened at St. Helens is less dramatic, but also was kind of new, and that is that volcanologists hadn't appreciated the long-lasting impacts that such an eruption can have on the landscape. And hydrologists who have studied the after effects of the eruption and the sediment load in the Toodle River and the time it is taking the hill slopes to restabilize have learned a lot of information that we really didn't appreciate before, that eruptions have a long tail of impact on society, much more than just the day or two of the eruption itself.
Well, I imagine a lot of our listeners will be inspired, especially here on this 40th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980, to go see it eventually when they can for themselves. And what would you want their big takeaway to be when they go to that visitor center and look out at that recovering landscape from 40 years ago?
Well, the big takeaway is that it can happen here. Any of the tall, active volcanoes in the Cascades could experience another May 18th kind of event. Now, it's more or less likely depending upon the volcanoes and whether or not there is a replay of May 18th. Though other volcanoes in the Cascades can erupt, can generate ash falls, pyroclastic flows, lahars down the river valleys. So people should come away from that visitor center, which is just a marvelous place to visit. I encourage everybody to do so. They should come away from there realizing that every volcano is an active Earth system. And if it isn't erupting today and it's not erupting tomorrow, it may erupt next century or it may erupt, whenever. But until the end of each volcano, it's going to keep erupting. And it's wise for people to remember that so they aren't surprised when things happen. And it's also important to remember that we can't control it. It might be nice to think that you could put your thumb on the volcano and keep it from erupting, but that's just not the case. And so you have to go with the flow of the volcano. And what this means is that in an ideal, in a perfect world, you would plan society around the potential for an eruption of a volcano. That's probably not going to happen. We all realize that. But people can at least be alerted from the St. Helens experience that there can be bad things happen when an eruption takes place. Finally, I urge people to listen to the scientists. There were people at St. Helens during April and May who scoffed at the scientists. One guy was quoted in the newspaper saying, it's just a ruse of the environmentalists. He discounted everything that we were saying. Please listen to what we're saying. We can be wrong, but if we're wrong, it's because that the volcano is doing something differently from what we've ever anticipated. But we're continually monitoring these volcanoes seismically and geodetically, and those kinds of data don't lie.
Yeah, I heard a statistic, I believe it was from Margaret Mangan, who's the chief of the California Volcano Observatory, that the chances of one of our Cascade volcanoes, like here in California or the Mono Lake area there, Long Valley Caldera, or Mount Shasta, Mount Lassen Peak, that the odds of an eruption are, kind of pretty similar to the odds of a major rupture of the San Andreas Fault. They don't happen often, but on a scale of every few hundred years, somewhere in the Cascades, they do.
That's right. That's right. And so it's hard for people to get excited about such low probability events, but when they happen, they can be really, really big. So it's just, you know, I hope that, you know, kids really should learn that in school. They should be learning about the subduction related earthquakes in the Northwest and the San Andreas kind of seismicity in California, and learning about volcanoes as well. So it's tucked in the back of their mind somewhere, so that when one of these things does happen or is about to happen, they can recall it. I think there's a lot of education that can be done for students now.
Yeah, certainly. And it's also it's kind of a chilling reminder that, you know, with this pandemic we're experiencing right now, kind of the last thing we would need is a disaster on top of it, which is not out of the realm of possibility.
I sure hope it doesn't happen, but you're right. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah. Well, Don, before we let you go, if you could go back in time and visit your young self when you first got interested in volcanoes and set out about this journey, what would you tell yourself as a kid? And, you know, looking back at the hindsight of all these years of great experience with these volcanoes, especially Mount St. Helens.
Well, I would tell myself that I made a pretty good decision. It's a decision that I've been able to build on all my career. And no looking back.
Well, I'm so glad you did. And thank you so much for joining us to share your memories and your expertise with the amazing story of the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Don Swanson, retired USGS volcanologist. He joined us from his home in Hilo, Hawaii. I'm lucky enough to live very close to an active volcanic center, Lassen Volcanic National Park. And while I marvel at the beauty of these mountains, I am also in awe when I consider the violent fire that birthed them. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.